by the other side of the lawn.
Yeah.
This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is November 18th. We're having, I'm having another session with Ted Finman in his office in the law building. If there is an abrupt stop, it's because the office has been knocked down by the giant machine outside. They're still knocking down parts of the law school for the proposed addition. Ted, last time we started our talk on the yours as chairman of the university committee, and we covered several issues. The last issue we covered was affirmative action. From there, I'd like to go to the topic of enrollment limits. What was your involvement, and what was the university committee's involvement in this issue?
Well, actually, during the time I was on the university committee, I don't recall that we were concerned with that issue. I can't say we weren't. I became very much involved. I don't remember just how long, but a few years after I was on the university committee, when Irv Shane, then chancellor, asked me to chair an ad hoc task force or committee on enrollment limits. And we can talk about that, even though it's subsequent to my time.
Well, yes, we definitely will. Out of the minutes, I did get that faculty enrollment limits were discussed during your tenure, and you did bring some issues before the faculty senate. So perhaps
I just don't remember that.
That's fine. Let's go on to what you do remember then, your involvement with that ad hoc committee.
Okay, Irv asked me to chair this committee, and it was a fairly sizable committee, I think a very good one, with a lot of faculty members who were interested and willing to work hard. And we worked, it must have been over a period of approximately a year, maybe a little less, maybe more. I can get that information for you, and ultimately developed a plan for limiting and indeed cutting back somewhat on enrollment. The problem, as Irv must have perceived it, and certainly as we perceived it, was essentially that enrollment was growing disproportionately to resources to handle it. And the concern was that that would dilute the quality of education. I can't remember the details of the plan we ultimately came up with for limiting and reducing, and this was undergraduate enrollment, but we did come up with such a plan. It was brought to the Senate and substantially discussed and ultimately adopted. It was then put into place, and again, I don't recall the details, but my kind of vague recollection is that it worked reasonably well to accomplish the goals that we'd set, which were not drastic. At that point, it was a matter of cutting back somewhat, but even more important, holding the line and not allowing undergraduate enrollment to grow, because the projections were that it would grow, and it was reasonably clear that resources were not going to grow accordingly.
Now, in terms of undergraduate, I don't know if you call it a cap on enrollment, would you call it a cap or leveling off of enrollment?
Mm-hmm.
In the early years of the 1970s, before this, and the late years of the 60s, there was a lot of finger-pointing on the part of citizens of Madison, et cetera, about the role of out-of-state students in the student riots. Was that at all involved in your...
It was not at all involved in this committee's deliberations, no.
Okay. And you had also mentioned before we went on tape about how this was the first enrollment policy for a system for...
Well, as I recall, this occurred before UW's system adopted an enrollment limit program for the whole system. That came a bit later. So in a way, we were really breaking new ground.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next issue, related somewhat to the affirmative action issue we talked about last time, was just the growing awareness of the needs of other types of students, the new minority that was enrolling at campus in the mid-70s. During your tenure, women's studies, Chicano studies, and Afro-American studies, the departments of, were all either under discussion or actually started during that period. What role did the university committee have in those proceedings? Do you remember?
Only in a very vague way. I do remember being personally involved in discussions having to do with women's studies. There was a committee that had been appointed. I don't know whether it came from the campus level or from Letters and Science, but there was a committee that had been working on this for some time, and at some point, I can't say just when, I became a part of those discussions. That probably was while I was on the university committee, and I don't recall in any more detail my own personal involvement. The questions the university committee would have been concerned about would be the obvious ones, whether there really is a discipline here that would warrant a department, and the concern about making sure that whatever innovations were made, either by way of establishing programs or especially departments, that quality was maintained.
Was there any discussion, as you recall, as to whether these were worthy for for actual inclusion as departments?
Well, I'm sure there must have been discussion. I don't recall it specifically, but I can't imagine that there would not have been discussion of that, since that was an obvious issue at the time.
What about curriculum? Who would have devised the curriculum for these various departments, and what role, if any, would the university committee and or the Senate faculty have in that?
University committee would not have had any role in developing the curriculum. That would have been the committee of faculty members who had been appointed to explore the development of the program or the department, and these would have been in large part, people who believed that the development of such a program was desirable. But I don't mean to in any way suggest by that they weren't concerned with a high-quality program. But they would have been the people who had expertise in the area and therefore would have been responsible for developing curricula. Faculty Senate would have had no role to play that I can think of in connection with the curricula per se. When it comes to degrees, I'd have to double check faculty policies and procedures, but I think degree requirements and establishing new degrees and such probably are matters where the Senate has an important role to play. But I don't think that was under discussion at that time.
Do you recall, and I'm sort of going backwards here, I should probably ask this first, was this something that just developed in the mid-70s, or was this a carryover from the late 60s?
I can't put my finger on the timing. Yeah. Well, I think Afro-American studies probably was carrying over from the late 60s. As to the others, I'm not sure.
Do you recall at all whether other campuses, whether we were the first in this area where other campuses were doing similar types of...
I can't say specifically, but this was part of the whole social movement throughout the country. So if we were the first, it was a bare first. There must have been others coming very soon after, and I'm sure that discussions of these things were going on simultaneously all over the country.
There was one other area that came up time and again in the minutes, and that was the role of the university committee in handling faculty grievances. Could you discuss that for a moment, perhaps giving us an example of one?
Yeah, a grievance, as that word is used in faculty policies and procedures, which give the university committee jurisdiction, so to speak, over, quote, grievances. A grievance is when a faculty member complains that he or she has been mistreated by the administration in some sense, either at the departmental level or some higher level, and the faculty member is seeking some redress against this mistreatment. That's to be distinguished from situations in which the administration seeks to impose discipline on a faculty member because of the faculty member's alleged misconduct. In that case, if there's a hearing, it would be before the Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities. The university committee would not be involved. But if, for example, a faculty member were to say, I've been treated unfairly with respect to annual raises, and I want to get the supplement to my raise, that would come before the university committee.
One case that did come before the university committee dealt with Professor Finley Campbell. Could you, that was, or seemed to be, a, or appeared to be a rather long-running one. Could you describe the parameters of that?
Well, I'm trying to recall what Professor Campbell's grievance was, and I think that it had to do with with his failure to get tenure. But the reason that I hesitate on that, because ordinarily that's a matter that would have gone to the Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities. So I'm a little bit at a loss to be sure of what he was complaining about. But I certainly do remember that it came, whatever it was, it came to the university committee, and it took a fair amount of time to hear from him and whoever else we heard from, and we found that he did not have a legitimate complaint. He elected, as someone is entitled to when they are dissatisfied with the decision of a faculty committee, he elected to bring that to the Faculty Senate to try and get the decision overturned by the Senate, and he did bring it, but the Senate agreed with the university committee.
When you handled grievance situations, was that done in closed session?
As best I recall, that would have been at the option of the faculty member complaining, but ordinarily there isn't anyone who is particularly interested. I don't recall what it was in Campbell's case.
Anyone listening to this, these cases are all, of course, in the university committee's files in the university archives, and they are public records. So if you'd like to follow through and see what types of cases, examples of the types of cases, you can certainly find that information there. Any other things about the university, your stay on the university committee, any other issues?
Nothing in particular that I recall.
During your years in the mid-70s, how successful do you think the, well, let's talk about your tenure specifically, How successful do you think you were in upholding the traditions of faculty governance? Now, you had some real threats coming at it during your tenure, especially with the collective bargaining bill. Do you think you left it as strong as you found it?
I think we did. On collective bargaining, that had been a threat both before I was ever on the university committee and continued to be a threat for a while after I was off the university committee. And at all those times, it has been successfully resisted. I think we added something to the strength of governance throughout the system by creating this group that we talked about, I think, at the last session, which consisted of representatives from the various prior Chapter 36 institutions, as well as from Oshkosh, UW-Oshkosh. I think that added some strength. On our own campus, I think our initial effort that we talked about before to resist the imposition of a system code that would have placed limits on outside income and so on, I think that added to the strength of faculty governance in that it demonstrated that faculty on our campus, not just the committee, but the whole faculty, was much concerned about matters. And I think that the regents responded to that concern by recognizing that what was being proposed was a real problem, and by changing it out of respect for the faculty's concerns. So I think that interaction strengthened the faculty, and that the faculty perceived that it could have an impact, and strengthened the system in that it was a good example of cooperation between faculty and administration, thinking now of the regents as sort of a part of overall administration.
You also benefited, did you not, from a chancellor who was really...
I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking just a few minutes ago that I wanted to say, in part, the strength of faculty governance has to depend on the sensitivity of administration to the value of this system. And certainly, in my experience on the university committee, Ed Young was, very sensitive to the value of the system, and it's not that he was going to abdicate authority to anybody, but he certainly respected the institution and cooperated in maintaining it.
As an outsider looking in over the years since your since you left the board, which was in '76, I think, June of '76. How do you think the university committee has fared in terms of maintaining its strong faculty government stance?
Well, I think it's varied. One important factor is, of course, the chair of the university committee. There have been strong chairs, and on occasion there's been a weak chair. And if you have a weak chair, the situation is not so good. And the other factor that's varied is the chancellor. And all of the chancellors who came to the job from inside UW-Madison understood and respected faculty governance. It's not at all clear to me that Chancellor Shalala had the same understanding or appreciation of the shared governance institution, or indeed that by attitude and temperament she really fitted into such a system.
We'll talk about that in a little bit more in the discussions on the athletic board. For my own information, I hope to interview this person sometime down the line. Who followed you as chairman of the...
I don't recall whether it was Steve Chaffee or Barney Webb who came immediately after I did. The two of them came in the 2 years after me. But it was either Barney or Steve who...
I think it was probably Steve then.
And then Barney came...
Barney just joined that last year that you were on.
Then
Steve
it was,
had been on for a couple
years. Steve came after me and Barney came after Steve.
Okay, great. Yeah. Settle that. Let's move on now to your... you managed in your years here at UW to, as I said to you on the phone the other day, managed to get your foot into every bucket of glue that you could find. And we're going to talk about another big bucket that that you were asked to work with, and that was the athletic board. You joined the athletic board at a time where there were some very, very significant issues that had to be dealt with, and issues that are still the decisions resulting from are still reverberating around the campus today. let's start out with your joining the board. How did that come about?
Well, Bernie Cohen, who was acting chancellor at the time, I think he was acting chancellor, not still vice chancellor. Irv Shane had left as chancellor and Bernie was acting chancellor. And Bernie was a good friend. And he called me and asked me if I would be on the athletic board and be one of our campus representatives to the Big Ten and to the NCAA. I was somewhat ambivalent about it, but ultimately decided to do it.
What was your ambivalence?
Well, it's a lot of time, and I had... it was going to take a lot of time, and I had thoughts about using my time more for research and writing at that point, and then I thought that I could do both, and so decided to do the athletic stuff. It ultimately turned out I couldn't really do both, or at least didn't really do both.
Did you realize at the time that you agreed to this that some of these things were coming down the pike, or were you in the middle?
Well, if what you're thinking about as the big issue is the elimination of some sports, no, that wasn't in the wind at all, because that didn't come up until there was a change in athletic directors.
Okay.
And when I came on the board, I'm trying to think of his name, of the...
Sponberg?
Yeah, Ate Sponberg was just newly appointed. He hadn't been athletic director long at all. And the new coach was just fairly new at the same
Morton,
time.
Right.
Yeah, Morton was new. So we were just, in effect, beginning that new era.
What was... not necessarily individuals, but what was the composition of the board? How many faculty members, how many athletic people? Do you have an approximate recollection of that?
Oh, and you could easily check this to be sure about it, but maybe something like 8 faculty and 4 alumni representatives, someone from Wisconsin Students Association, and a student representative of the student athletes. That's approximately the composition.
Can you characterize the relationship? There's sort of a triangle existing here in athletics. There's the athletic board, there's the athletic department, and there's the chancellor's office.
Mm-hmm.
It has not always been a real smooth sailing operation. What was that, how was that triangle functioning at the point that you came on the board?
Well, there was no difficulty insofar as the chancellor's office is concerned, because the chancellor's office pretty much was leaving things to the athletic board and the department. One of the reasons that Bernie asked me to join the board is because he wanted someone who would take a strong position on the importance of academic interests, even when they clashed with the interest in athletic success, and there's always a tension between those two. As for the relationship between the board and the department, I would describe it as generally cordial at a personal level. There was some substantial concern on the part of some of us on the board about maintaining academic standards, and that was a concern at two levels. At the recruitment level, whether people were being recruited who didn't have the qualifications to do reasonably well at UW-Madison, but were being recruited because they were good athletes. And then there was concern about maintenance of standards once people were recruited.
Mm-hmm. Did you have, were your concerns based on specific things, or was it just sort of a general concern?
No, it was based on, specific things, particular people who had been recruited, instances where people didn't do well, questions about whether coaches were in any way trying to interfere with the academic process. And I should point out that when I talk about all this, the problems that we perceived, those of us who are really concerned about this, existed almost exclusively in the football and basketball programs. Not really in hockey, though that's an income sport too, but hardly at all in the non-income sports.
When we'll get back to that as we move through this. Both Sponberg and Morton were subsequently fired. What was your role? What was the board's role in that?
I think the firing of Sponberg was essentially Chancellor Shalala's decision. Feelings on the board would have been somewhat mixed, though there was substantial sentiment that aid just wasn't suited to this particular job. He wasn't really managing it very well, and a substantial concern that his prior relationship with Don Morton, because they had been friends and I think together at as director and coach at another institution, that was coloring his capacity objectively to assess Morton's capabilities. There were concerns, and Donna ultimately decided to dismiss Sponberg.
Now, was a budget deficit, or was that part of the problem?
Oh yeah, sure, because the perception was that the budget deficit was, at least in some significant part, due to mismanagement, and of course due in significant part to the failure of the football team to perform and thus to draw crowds into the stadium. When we come to the changing of the coach, there I think the board had a very substantial role, because a special committee was established from the board, was established to review the whole situation and make a recommendation to Donna Shalala about whether to get rid of Morton and look for a new coach. And she at least says that she relied heavily on that committee's recommendation, which was to find a new coach. And she has said to me at one time or another that she also took heavily into account the judgment of those who believed that Morton was not adequately concerned about academic standards, which clearly was my view and the view of the other people who had worked closely with him on this matter and tried to influence him and exert some control over this matter. You may be interested in knowing just how the board did get into the matter of academic standards and try to exert an influence. One of the committees of the board at that time was called the Eligibility Committee, which I chaired while I was on the board. The Eligibility Committee had responsibility for passing judgment on cases where people were not attending to their academics. Both the Big Ten and the NCAA have eligibility rules. Athletes must, in order to be eligible to be recruited in the first instance and then to be eligible to play subsequently, must meet certain academic standards established by those institutions. They're pretty minimal. We did not have any additional grade point standards, but we did have some requirements like that people attend classes and so on. And to some extent, the department was supposed to keep track of these matters and bring to the eligibility committee any cases in which an individual athlete was not complying with our requirements. So we had cases of that sort come to the eligibility committee, and we had to make a judgment about what to do, whether to declare the athlete ineligible, let them have a second chance, or whatever. So that's one way in which the board had a role here. The other way was that the eligibility committee also had as part of its responsibility to look at the criteria that were being applied in recruitment. First of all, make sure that the NCAA and Big Ten rules were being observed. But secondly, to see whether, in addition, to that, the programs were recruiting marginal people, academically marginal people, or too many academically marginal people. And we clearly did feel that there were problems of that sort, especially in the football program. And Barney Webb, who was chair of the board at the time, and I played a special role in raising these issues with Sponberg and with Morton, and you know, trying to get them to apply higher standards. I don't think we were terribly successful in that respect, but we put a lot of time and effort into it.
How did they respond to you generally?
Oh, they responded, of course, by saying, oh, of course, we're concerned about this, and so on and so forth. But Morton's behavior, in my judgment, never demonstrated that adequate concern about academics was there. And Aid was, just reluctant to really get tough with Morton.
That's interesting. So some of those concerns about who's running whom might have been correct. You said that there was a concern that he might be a little bit too beholden to Morton.
Well, I wouldn't say beholden. I don't think he felt beholden to Morton. But Morton was a friend, and Aid would have felt some confidence and trust in Morton, would have been reluctant to lay down the law, so to speak, because he would have wanted to feel that he could rely on Morton. I think it's that kind of dynamic that was operating.
You mentioned a little while ago the name of another very key player in this whole issue, and that was the new chancellor, Chancellor Shalala. How did her view of the role of sports on campus life differ from her predecessor? What was her view, as you saw?
Well, I think that chancellors that I'm familiar with prior to Donna kept some distance from the athletic program. They would become concerned if other people became concerned, if they felt pressure from outside. But they, to the best of my knowledge, except when there were crises or semi-crises, didn't feel that it was their role to allocate an important part of themselves to the athletic program. They pretty much left that to the board and the department unless there was some special problem. Of course, when Donna came, there were problems. So it's hard to say how she would have approached or what her attitude toward athletics would have been if she had come at a time in which everything was running just very smoothly and well. And she might have assumed the same more distant position, but plenty of indication that, you know, she really had a deep personal interest in athletic programs and wanted to be more deeply involved. She certainly did become very quickly much more deeply involved than chancellors had in the past.
Was that involvement mainly limited to the big sports?
Well, I should say what I mean by being involved, and it is linked with the situation that she faced when she came here. She became involved in key decisions about whether to replace the athletic director. Now, when there's been a problem of that in the past, the person who was chancellor certainly was involved in that it is the chancellor's ultimate authority and responsibility to select a new athletic director, if there's going to be one. The board has to pass on that too, but the chancellor has a very key role. Now, Donna became immediately involved in that whole question of whether to dismiss Sponberg, and then having made that decision in the whole process of trying to find a new director. Unlike, I think, the process which led to the selection of Sponberg, which was really a board process of searching and screening for a new director, this was a process of Donna primarily being the person who searched and screened for a new director. She really went out and recruited Pat Richter, who initially had said he didn't want to be considered, but she ultimately convinced him to take the job.
What, from what you know about the board and everything, what would, he had a very nice job, for people who might not be aware of this, as personnel director at Oscar Mayer. It was a real nice lifetime job that he could have had. What would she have said, do you think, that would have lured him into a real abyss, the abyss of UW athletics at the time?
Well, I don't recall whether I heard this from Pat or heard it from Donna or where, or from both or other sources, but I think what finally got to Pat Richter was the idea of, in a sense, having his own shop to run, rather than being an employee of some other institution, that this would be his enterprise to develop, and he would have the responsibility for it, and so on. That's what attracted him to it. And in a way, from my perspective, that's also what created a lot of tension thereafter. And I think that's what, in effect, what Donna promised him.
Tension from?
Well, because if you view it as your enterprise, that immediately begins to create tension with the board. If the board feels that it should have an important role in making important decisions and not simply be a rubber stamp for the director.
Another major change, which we've talked about a little bit earlier, is after Richter came on board, it became very clear to an outsider like me that UW was pointing toward a more big-time role in athletics. Is this just was that Donna's vision, do you think, when she came, or is this just something that came
well, I'm not. What do you mean by
well,
a big-time role?
Well, they were going to stop being in the finishing eighth in the Big Ten and calling it a good season in football, and that they were going to go to really to get the kind of team that, believe it or not, might someday go to a Rose Bowl. Serena Pondren was talking about that last week when I talked to her on your advice there was a new sort of energy and ambition that was initiated into the athletic department that hadn't really been there prior to this.
I suppose that it certainly the whole flavor of the environment changed from Aide to Pat. Aide was very low-key kind of person, and it wasn't only Pat, it's, I can't remember his first name, but Fish.
Oh, Al Fish.
Al Fish. It was a much more vigorous administration in the athletic department. But on the other hand, I don't think anybody was feeling that it's perfectly fine to finish eighth in the Big Ten in football and basketball and so on. I think everybody wanted to do better, but maybe the drive or the intensity of the drive to get up in the top ranks changed and increased substantially with Richter and Fish.
Well, there were also things that I remember reading about in the newspaper that I certainly hadn't recalled any other chancellor doing. For example, Chancellor Shalala got actively involved in the recruiting process and would actually spend time on the recruiting weekends at the Shell or the McLean Center.
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that Donna had the same kinds of ambitions to raise the success level of the program. She wanted to go to the Rose Bowl as much as anybody wanted to go to the Rose Bowl. So that, and that is different, yeah.
And for viewers, listeners.
Of course, she also, she certainly had a lot more contact with the alumni representatives on the board than, so far as I know, other chancellors had. She was just more active in general.
For people who are listening 50 years from now, Wisconsin did go to the Rose Bowl last year, and by golly, they won. One of the major issues confronting the athletic board during your years on it, how long were you on?
I think it was 3 years, three full years.
Was the sports cutting measure. Mm-hmm. Could you give us some background on give me some background on that?
Yeah. The question about whether to eliminate some sports arose as a part of the whole problem of how to deal with the deficit in the budget. And the administration, that is Richter and Fish, began to think about this and make plans and would raise some questions about it with the board, and there was some interaction, and there were various what you might call trial balloons floated.
You mean naming sports that might
Yeah, happen? Right. And as I recall, one of those sort of proposals that was floated involved baseball and fencing, and gymnastics, and maybe one other thing. I don't recall exactly. And there were a number of us on the board who were very concerned about one aspect or another of that proposal, and there were very serious questions about the need to cut any sports in order to deal with a budget deficit problem. In any event, there was a period in which there were informal discussions. I remember going to talk to Pat Richter and telling him what I felt was tenable and what I was prepared to support, which would have been to cut baseball, but not to cut either gymnastics or fencing. Fencing in particular involved $50,000 a year, which was a drop of a drop in the bucket, and just absolutely absurd to cut that. Ultimately, they brought in, or the committee of the board, which had been considering this, brought in some proposals for consideration. I think the sequence probably would have been that the administration brought a proposal to the board's committee, which then considered it and brought some things to the board. Or at first there was, I think, a committee meeting, which really was an open meeting for all members of the board, at which things were discussed, and I'm trying to remember just what the vote was, but there was not a vote of approval for this. Indeed, there was a vote of support for a much modified proposal. And then at the full board meeting, which was to discuss this, instead of bringing in that modified proposal, at that full board meeting, which was not attended by all members of the board, and not in particular by all faculty members, there was a close vote in favor of cutting of the proposal that had been advanced by the athletic board administration, and backed by the chair of the board, who at that time was Roger Formisano. And Roger was not a very adept chair. Roger, and you have to recognize my personal view, and I had gotten along with Roger very well up to that point, but I came to believe that he was being very manipulative and not trying to discuss things with the board, but just push things through if he felt he had a majority. So my view of Roger is a biased one. But anyway, he did not try and build any kind of consensus among the board, and he simply backed what the athletic department administration wanted, and was not willing to listen to anything else, and this really I think was responsible for the blow up, the unwillingness to compromise, the unwillingness to really take seriously other people's point of view, as well as what I would characterize as and a substantially erroneous and misleading presentation by the administration, and in particular by Al Fisch, of just what the budgetary problem was. And Bobby Wolf and I put in a lot of time and effort analyzing this, Bobby being especially skilled at this, having substantial background in economic and statistical analysis. And I'm trying to remember the name of the other board member.
Kolchinsky,
Jerry Kolchinsky independently did a lot of detailed analysis of the budgetary situation, and it simply wasn't as represented. And one of the things that simply wasn't as represented was the time pressure. The administration said we had to do this in 5 years. If you go out and talk to any of the people from whom the pressure supposedly was coming, the governor's office, the legislature, and so on, it simply was not the case that anybody, or that there was any substantial insistence on solving the problem within 5 years. There certainly was substantial insistence on dealing effectively with the problem and starting to deal with it effectively. But the representation that we had to do it within 5 years was false. And moreover, if you took into account a whole bunch of financial factors that weren't built into Al Fisch's projections, it was very clear that we could make substantial progress even in the short term, 2 or 3 years, without cutting all the sports that they wanted to cut.
Why did they do that then? What was their intention?
Well, I think they perceived, and this perception may have been a correct political perception, that if all they cut was baseball, it would be a political nightmare for them. And so they had to tag onto it some other sports, so that baseball wasn't just hanging out there all by itself, because baseball was the sport that received the largest outside political support. The outside, the hue and cry about sports cutting was largely focused in terms of outside pressure on baseball. There was more complaint about cutting baseball than anything else. So I think they felt they couldn't get away with that, and so they had to tack on other sports.
Why gymnastics? It seems, we have a strong tradition of gymnastics.
That's right.
In the state. It's
I don't know how they came to make that particular choice. What the reasons were for making that particular choice, but you could have said the same thing about almost about any other of the non-income sports,
rowing,
swimming,
wrestling.
Track, wrestling, any of those programs. You know, maybe their perception was that fencing and gymnastics had the least political support, so they were the easiest targets. But I'm sure that's true about fencing. It's incredible to think that there's a need to cut fencing, which saves you almost nothing.
Well, I've even heard it said that one of the reasons for cutting gymnastics might have been as a way of emptying that space in the red gym.
No, I don't think that's so. There was great doubt at the time about whether the red gym project would really go forward, and there were alternative places that could deal with gymnastics. And Bobby and I developed all of that in what we presented to the board.
What about the question of gender?
And incidentally, while we're on the subject, Fisch directly misrepresented a variety of things, including some actions that the NCAA had taken that past January. there was a document that was going to be distributed to the board at one of the crucial meetings that had been prepared by Fish, which discussed, among other things, what savings we could expect from other places as a result of actions taken by the NCAA to reduce the number of coaches and supporting staff that would be permissible. And that document represented that these actions, in effect, had not been taken as final actions, that they were sort of tentative. When I saw that document, I just saw red. And I went to Pat Richter and pointed it out, and I said, you know damn well as I do, that is not true, that the actions taken at the NCAA were final actions and they were the law now. There were people within the NCAA who didn't like those actions and were seeking to bring them up for review again. But there was very little likelihood that any attempt to change the action that had been taken would be successful. And yet Al Fish was representing the action as tentative. And when Pat saw it, he said, yes, well, we'll change that. Okay. They changed it in the document, and I have ever since regretted ever raising it, because it would have politically been much more effective to let the document go to the board with what was unequivocally and unambiguously these false statements, and then be able to point it out to the board.
So that was intentional by Al Fish to have done that?
Well, he knew damn well what happened at the NCAA meeting. He was there.
What about the question of gender in baseball? Was that an issue at that point?
Well, that was another factor probably in the calculations about what they believed they had to do. There was a serious problem about equity as between men's and women's sports, and one of the proposals being discussed to deal with that was the development of women's softball. And as long as men's baseball was one of the sports that we maintained, introducing women's softball was an obvious way to try and deal with a gender equity problem. That would have been expensive. That would have added to the budgetary problem. So by eliminating baseball, not only do you save the money from baseball, but you now put a damper on the proposal to introduce women's softball. I think the administration felt that it was imperative to eliminate baseball. And as I said before, that was not feasible if you targeted only baseball.
I should point out, ironically, that women's softball started as a sport here.
I know.
Just a few months ago, I believe. We're in late 1994. One of the issues that Serena talked about was, you could almost call it court packing, in terms of the committee, that the committee began to be, the people who left were replaced by people...
You mean the athletic board.
The athletic board, right?
Yeah.
Do you recall that happening?
Well, I'm confident that... And at that time, the appointment of board members was within the discretion of the chancellor. I'm perfectly confident that Donna made pretty damn sure that the people she appointed shared her views on the issues that she considered to be critical. She's a very political animal, and I can't imagine her not doing that.
So the board was a very political, the athletic board became a political hot potato. Sense.
Well, I'm not sure what that means.
No, I'm not sure what that means.
From Donna's perspective, these would have been political appointments in the sense that she wanted to be sure that she was appointing people who would support her position on various things.
Uh, this issue then went before the Faculty Senate, did it not?
Yes, there were some procedural aspects of the whole process in the Athletic Board that made it procedurally appropriate, or possible at least, to bring it before the Faculty Senate. And incidentally, it had been considered extensively by the University Committee as well. And the University Committee, the first vote taken by the board did not have, there was not a faculty majority at the board meeting. I think that was the requirement that was not satisfied. And that was brought to the attention of the University Committee. This is my best recollection of the sequence, but there was so much going on. In any event, the University Committee, after considering the whole problem, sent it back to the board to take another vote. That vote was extremely close, although the department administration still prevailed. At that point, I think maybe as a formal matter, the students took the matter to the Senate. It was possible to appeal this matter to the Senate. One way or another, it got to the Senate, and those of us, some of us on the board who felt strongly about it, wanted it to get to the Senate. And although we may not have been the people who formally placed it before the Senate, I just don't remember, we certainly encouraged it if we weren't the formal actors. There were various arguments made before the Senate at the proposal, and I think, if I recall correctly, that I either drafted or participated in drafting the proposal that was put to the Senate, was to postpone any action on sports cutting until there was time for further consideration and until the various athletes who would just to make sure that the other tape caught everything. The proposal that went to the Senate was to postpone action on sports cutting until it could be studied further, and the student athletes who would not have any opportunity to participate once their sports were cut would have a further opportunity to look elsewhere to see whether they could get into programs at other institutions and so on. And the Senate adopted that proposal by, I think, a vote that was one or two votes short of being unanimous. Oh yeah. Chancellor Shalala nonetheless went ahead with implementing the sports cutting. And I think that probably contributed to the feeling of a fair number of people that the faculty governance didn't mean a great deal within her administration.
I would say I could see why people felt that way. Did she understand the implications of what she was doing?
I'm not sure.
Just a little brief side tangent here. Did she ever really catch on to the whole notion of faculty governance?
Well, I think she understood the notion. Whether she valued it or agreed with it or simply saw it as a necessary evil, something that she had to deal with, that's a very different question.
The sports were cut, and as I might have mentioned before, the reverberations are still felt around campus today.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me about that.
Well, very briefly, and this is interesting because it goes along with this, I was invited to a non-income sports fundraiser a summer or two ago, and it was out at a farm somewhere, one of the donors, and it was fun, and everybody got together at the end, and Pat Richter got up on a hay wagon or something to give a speech, and people were still angry. Well, this was a non-income sports thing, and there were still questions about baseball, gymnastics,
really?
Like that. And Again, I saw him at Camp Randall a while ago. After the team was coming out of the tunnel, I happened to get caught in a little mess and I couldn't cross, and Richter came trotting in after Alvarez, and two or three people who were stuck there with me started yelling about yelling to him, cussing at him about the cutting of baseball. So the field, the feelings are still quite quite intense on this campus, yeah. At least through my limited experience.
More power to them.
There was one other level that we haven't discussed on this sports cutting issue, and that of course involves the Board of Regents. What can you tell us about their particular perceptions of this issue?
Well, I think the regents in general were concerned about the budgetary situation. I don't think that a large number of regents were taking the position that we had a five-year timeline and had to solve everything within that period, but they certainly were concerned about the budget. And there was probably some significant sentiment within the regents that they really ought to back Richter, because Richter was the CEO of the athletic department. And incidentally, I think, let's come back to Donna in a moment when we finish with the regents. I know that one of the regents who was very vociferous about all these matters and about sports cutting and backing Richter and so on was Ab Nicholas. You know, he was a former basketball player for UW, if I remember correctly. And I know that Donna felt that she had to back Richter. Aside from the merits of the proposal, you got to a certain position, whether a certain point in time as things developed, where a key issue from Donna's perspective became whether she backed her man or not. And I think I think she believed that the proposal was correct on the merits. But maybe of equal importance in her mind in what she did was that in recruiting Richter, she had promised him support. And she had to give him that support on, not to back him would have been a vote of no confidence in effect. And she may have felt that that would be unfair to him, but in addition to that, she was under pressure from regents and alumni and so on, and I think she probably worried about whether her position would be tenable if she didn't back him fully. I think she could have intervened in a political way, maybe to get him to modify a position, but maybe she just never thought that that was politically necessary.
Well, her action right after the faculty senate vote would imply to me, at least, that she was really offering him total support on this.
Yeah. She also didn't realize at first what a bloody mess Roger Formisano was making of the whole thing, because she was intending to keep Roger on as chair of the board and indeed to make him to have him then take over as representative to the NCAA and to the Big Ten. And he had even attended at least one NCAA meeting as a kind of observer to sort of break him in. When Donna finally realized how ineptly he had handled this whole matter, and when the university committee said to Donna that they simply were not going to swallow his being the representative to the NCAA and Big Ten, she backed off of that and told him that he couldn't have it, even though she'd previously promised it to him. That was a not easy thing for her to do, but I think that that happened because she was aware of substantial fallout as a result of her disregard of the Senate's vote on the sports cutting. And she wasn't prepared to buck the university committee when it said to her that they didn't want Roger in that position.
I have a promise from the chancellor that when she's finished with healthcare and everything and she's in Madison sometime, I will interview her and I will definitely ask her questions about this. But could you, we'll finish up this segment of the interview, could you name a couple of other people who were involved in that whole thing who you think I might want to interview?
Sure, Diane Kravitz.
Diane Kravitz.
Who was chair of the university committee at that time.
Okay.
But I wouldn't trust them.
On that note, we will end this conversation.